cops could rape with impunity. Because who's going to believe a drug addict, right? Who's going to believe somebody who's addicted to a substance and will do anything to get that substance, including lie? Who's going to believe somebody who's been in and out of prison the majority of their adult life? He came into the room that had been Deborah's all her life, and was going to be Chino's for all of his childhood, too. Nobody knows now what took place next. Rose told Chino it was a rape, because that is what Deborah told her. Years later, Chino will wonder. Maybe, I don't know. I totally think he raped my mother, but I also think that maybe some prostitution stuff happened, or she traded freedom for sex. Was that common then? It's common now, he says, in 2012. Deborah went into labor in a bar. Chino was born with a severe blood disorder in a hospital a few blocks away from where Arnold Rothstein died. He weighed only a few pounds, and he had a thin layer of skin over his eyes. The doctor said this was the result of his mother's drug use during pregnancy, and they thought he was blind and would be mentally disabled. But as her mother had abandoned her, Deborah immediately abandoned Chino. And the same Mrs. Harden, now in her 60s, took in the baby and raised him, too, as her own. She was a strict grandmother. She had grown up in a place and time when disobedient kids were told to go to the woods to find a branch to be beaten with. It was called picking your switch. But, at the same time, she was an old woman, and her powers to discipline or to understand this new little child were fading. Chino called Mrs. Harden Ma. Even now and then, he was taken to a strange place to see Deborah. He saw only that she was a short, wiry woman who wore men's clothes and had a smile just like Chino's. Deborah, he says later, was my biological mother, and only in that sense. Some part of Deborah never forgot her child and longed for him. One day, she turned up in Flatbush and took the toddler Chino away by the hand, so he could be hers for once. They hid out for days, not telling anyone where they were. It was a motel. The police arrived. They said they were looking for Victor's daughter. All those years, it turned out, Victor had kept an eye on his child from a distance, and when he heard Chino had been kidnapped, his colleagues rallied to find the kid. Years later, Deborah snatched him again. When I spoke to him about it, Chino remembered playing in a dollhouse with a little girl and eating chips when, suddenly, a woman Deborah owed money to took him by the hand to another room. Chino saw a blade with brass knuckles on it. It is only years later that Chino would realize where they were, in a crack house. Out of nowhere, the woman was trying to insert this blade into Chino's vagina. Chino managed to hit her with some toys and scream as loud as he could. Deborah appeared and saw what was happening. Deborah and her friend dragged the woman onto the roof of the crack house. They began to beat her as hard as they could. I don't know if she lived or not, Chino will remember, but I remember a lot of blood and the woman not moving anymore. His little 8-year-old self felt happy. It was a moment when his mother most appeared to love him. Deborah appeared every now and then in Chino's life after that, but infrequently, in manic jags. Why did she keep circling back? I think the circumstances didn't allow her love for me to ever fruitfully grow, Chino speculates. The seedling hatched, it pulled out of the ground, but it never bore any fruit. He always wanted boys' toys, especially G.I. Joe's. He only liked the toy oven he had been given because he could melt the G.I. Joe's heads in it. My grandmother had to beat me into a dress, he remembers. From about 8 years old, he pushed his hair up demanded to be called Jason, and put socks down as underwear. His grandmother asked him why, and he said that being a girl sucks, and in my life it did suck. Deborah was the first person ever to punch Chino in the face. When he was 12, Chino found his mother sleeping in a bush behind the house, and he was embarrassed and angered. Anybody could see her, homeless, openly gay, filthy. And so he turned the hose on her. He figured he had enough time between Deborah getting up and him getting back into the house, but he miscalculated. So Deborah lumps me up like Mike Tyson, as he put it. Chino learned to lash out first whenever his mother appeared. He threw a pot at her out of a window once and cracked Deborah's head open. He threw scissors out the window and opened up Deborah's finger, so the next day she caught Chino after school and beat him again. And yet sometimes Chino went looking for Deborah, in the park, on the benches, or on the corner where she could be looking for business, because Chino wanted her. Usually, she was nowhere to be found. Around this time, across the United States, a new blood-borne disease was being uncovered. People were staggering into hospitals and collapsing. It was causing strange symptoms, as if it was a sudden, rapidly killing cancer. Scientists quickly realized the people in most danger were gay men and injecting drug users who shared needles. They recommended handing out clean needles as a matter of urgency. The Scottish city of Glasgow, which had a massive drug injection problem, became one of the first in the world to do this. As a result, fewer than 2% of their injectors became HIV positive. In New York City, they refused to do it. So by 1992, 50% of the city's injectors were HIV positive, including Deborah. When the authorities finally relented, it brought down new infections by 75%. It was too late for this story. Indeed, the people who tried to get Deborah and all the users like her clean needles were threatened with arrest. As an adult, Chino would have about 10 memories of Deborah. Half were violent and despairing, half were good. One time she turned up and stole Chino's back-to-school clothes so she could sell them. They went skating once. They went to Coney Island once and got on the cyclone, and Deborah held his head the whole time. They went to see a movie, the Tina Turner biopic, What's Love Got to Do With It? Another time she talked Chino through how they were related and who her own biological mother was. Somewhere along the way, Deborah told him that she was HIV positive, but Chino didn't quite understand what that meant. One time, when he was 12, Chino went to see Deborah in a psychiatric unit. He brought her a knish, her favorite food. Deborah obsessively asked Chino who he was having sex with. Chino explained he wasn't having sex with anyone, but Deborah kept asking, insistent. Looking back on this, Chino would realize she was trying to give him all the guidance she could on the tiny range of subjects in which she felt able to dispense advice, knowing time was short. The last time Deborah came home from her stints in and out of jail, she announced she had found Jesus and was wearing a dress. Chino couldn't remember ever seeing her in a dress before. She had a boyfriend, a real jerk whom Chino hated, but he was at least reassured to see that his mother was, for the first time in Chino's life, undrugged. It didn't last long. One day Chino came home and his mother was frantically searching the house, looking in strange places, for something unnamed, unseen. She believed something was hidden inside the radiator. She was due to take Chino to the movies, but she was clearly in a crack frenzy, and soon she ran out of the house screaming, vanishing down the street. Chino started to run after her, but then thought to himself, "I'm not going to fucking run after her. I'm tired of looking for her. If she goes, she goes." Later that night, there was a call from the hospital. Chino and Mrs. Hardin went to see her. The body in the bed, stuffed with tubes, looked incomprehensible to Chino. Deborah's tiny body had blown up as if she had already been filled with embalming fluid. Her face and hands were distended and misshapen. The nurses said Deborah had been trying to rob a woman on the bus, and when the police arrived to arrest her, they beat her. But her liver was already destroyed, and she had water on the brain. Deborah would never wake up again. She was 33 years old. At the funeral, Deborah's boyfriend sneered at Chino.
"So," he said, "you'll cry for her now?"
Not long after, Chino found his corner and started selling his crack. And 3 years after that, when he was 16, he would smoke it for the first time.
"I wanted to know," he would say to me years later, "what she chose over me."
Chino was first put into a jumpsuit and caged when he was 13. He was sent to Spofford Juvenile Detention Center in the Bronx as punishment for his violent street shit against other teenagers, which he carried out because the dealing puts me in positions where my default emotion is anger and my default position is retaliation. The paint was peeling on the walls. There was a stench of mold in the air. There was no fresh air anywhere. It was almost hard to breathe. Nobody asked if he was okay. Nobody tried to talk to him about why he was there. Their manner wasn't cold or aggressive. It was utterly indifferent. The staff looked at the kids as objects on a loading line that it was their job to briefly inspect. As Chino puts it, instead of bottles or sneakers, this loading line happens to hold humans.
"Do you have any medical conditions? Are you sexually active? Next!"
In this child prison, you could watch TV, watch TV, or watch TV. Oh, or you could play spades. Chino remembers, "To say I felt alone would be an understatement. I felt like an animal." When you go to prison, the one thing you gotta check at the door is not your wallet or your jewelry. It's your humanity. He was being taught, in stages, that life is a series of shakedowns and shootouts, punctuated by boredom. In prison, being humane can get you fucking hurt. Simple shit like, if you're home in the world and somebody knocks on your door and says, "Can I borrow some toothpaste and a cup of sugar?" You're like, "Why not? It's fucking sugar. Who cares? Take the whole fucking thing." You don't do that shit in jail. You can't do that shit in jail. That just opens up the door for a lot of bullshit. People thinking you're a punk and they can just take from you. It's called friendly extortion. It's like, "I know you want to give me that, right? I know you want to give me a pack of cigarettes." That's me threatening you without saying, "Unless you give me that, I'm going to punch you in the face." But I was scared, as a child, because that's what I was, of the unknown, of what the next day would bring. In one cell, when he was 16, he decided this story had to end. He couldn't take it. He couldn't take the slow process of morphing into his mother, of erasing himself from existence day by day. Better to do it in one sudden fall. He made a noose out of his shoelaces. He double-tied them so they could slip down nicely, but not slip out. He tied them to the top of the bar. He jumped. And there was all this fucking slack hanging down, saving him. And he thought, "I'm such a fuck-up. I can't even get this shit right." He tried again when he was out. He overdosed on sleeping pills twice, but they pumped his stomach and put him back on the street. Rikers Island is a vast concrete fortress in the East River, suspended in water between Queens and the Bronx. More than 14,000 people are warehoused in its stone cells, and it became a second home to Chino and his crew, as it has to generations of teenagers from his neighborhood. But something strange was happening. His drug charges kept disappearing. He was arrested and charged, but the paperwork seemed to vanish. "If you look at my criminal record on its face," Chino says, "I got let out of the back door of the courthouse a lot, without even seeing a judge. I got let go from the precinct. I had charges that you cannot believe they still let me go." He was certainly beating the odds. If you're a part-time street dealer in the District of Columbia, a place with similar demographics and drug use to East Brooklyn, you have 22% chance of being jailed for each year you work. But Chino had been dealing for nearly a decade without being imprisoned for these offenses. He always got busted for other crimes. Some of his crew began to suspect he was a snitch. But if he had been, sooner or later the evidence would have come out at trial. And it never did. Chino was puzzled. Why them and not him? Gradually, Chino believed he had figured out what was really going on. Victor had come looking for him when he was a child. Victor had sent his colleagues to find him when he was kidnapped by Deborah. And now that he was a teenager, Victor was, Chino became convinced, still watching over him from a distance, getting his colleagues to lose his drug charges down the back of their filing cabinets. Is this evidence of more police corruption, or does Chino want so much to believe that his rapist father loves him, despite everything, that he is seeing his hand in the random glitches and failings of a bureaucratic criminal justice system? He only ever met Victor once. When Chino was in his teens, one of his cousins told him Victor wanted to see him, and he named the corner of Nostrand and Church in Brooklyn, and a time. Victor wheeled toward him. He had, Chino discovered, been shot years before, and was now a paraplegic. His first thought was, "Wow, he wears his hair just like mine, in a ponytail." Then he noticed his dad was wearing cut-off leather gloves, just like his mother used to. But he didn't want to hear what Victor had to say.
"What do you want?" he asked him. "I want to get to know you."
"You should have thought of that before you raped my mother and before you walked out of my life," he replied. His conversation was rambling. Victor said that his mother was very top-heavy, like Chino. He said his two sons had died in a plane crash. He seemed half crazy. Chino explained,
"From the way he approached me, it's almost like we had a relationship."
Like he knew him. Like they had been talking all along. Chino didn't want to know. He walked away. A few years later, somebody told him Victor had died. He didn't go to the funeral. But for Chino, in East Flatbush at 15, he was discovering newer and bolder crimes. Now that he had formed his crew to sell crack, they found they worked well together and could push it further. Prohibition functioned for him as a gateway drug to robbery and assault. In prison, they were constantly learning about new crimes and new techniques and graduating from this university back onto the streets. They robbed boats in the harbor, taking flare guns and cool Nautica jackets. They tried to get the boats to start up, and whenever this happened, Chino would laugh and say, "So, if we get it started, where the fuck are we going? We're okay." They stole cars. They beat people up. Chino's best friend at this time, Jason Santiago, tells me that being a gangster was emotional armor for Chino. With a gun and Tupac blaring behind you, you're untouchable, so you can't be hurt. There is, he says, a doubleness to this gangster front. You need to appear tough so other people don't fuck with you, but you also need to be tough to convince yourself you can walk into an urban battlefield every day and survive. Chino did everything the boys did, and that included taking girlfriends. I had to make sure they saw me at all times as an equal,
and as a dude, and not a chick. I think I did that for my safety as well, he would recall. The more they saw me like them, the less likely I was to be abused, or have to fucking kill somebody. If he didn't establish this reputation, I probably would have been raped, killed, or imprisoned. He defied anyone to criticize him for being a lesbian, which is how he was seen at the time. Apart from a few stray comments on the street, they were too afraid to do it. As Chino guided me through his world, I kept thinking about the parts of ghetto culture that seemed irrational and bizarre to outsiders. The obsession with territory, the constant demand for respect. And I began to think maybe they are not so irrational. You have no recourse to the law to protect your most valuable pieces of property, your drug supply. So you have to make damn sure people show you respect and stay out of your territory. The demand for respect, I began to see, is the only way this economy can function. If enough of the local economy is run by these rules, they come to dominate the neighborhood, even the people who manage to stay out of the drug trade. One of Chino's homies, a guy nicknamed File, had links to a gang in Newport, Virginia, who needed new suppliers. They drove out there to negotiate, and it was there, far from home, that Chino made the decision to try crack. I did exactly what I was already doing when I was toting guns and being crazy, which was the heart. It was a pure physical thing, he remembers. It was like the heart, boom, boom, boom. You're definitely hyped. It only lasts for 5 minutes. Then you need another hit, and another hit. And before you know it, you've been up for 4 fucking days, looking horrible. And things that used to be a lot more important in your life, like bathing and brushing your teeth and, oh, I don't know, eating, become less and less important than chasing it, he says. That was it. I was on a crack mission. That first time, he kept going and was high for a week. And he knows he must have nodded off a few times, but there was no bedtime, no REM sleep, no rest. And crack, so much crack, and strippers and prostitutes all piling into his hotel room, and now there is a party rolling and ripping through it, and Chino does what the men do. He fucks the hose, he rolls, he smokes. Arnold Rothstein was a psychopath. He found it easy to play the role Prohibition had handed him, as the amoral terrorizer. Chino said to me one afternoon, I'm pretty sure people will read this and think, damn, Chino had borderline sociopathic tendencies. But as he tried to play the role Prohibition required of him, Chino found something awkward and unwanted breaking through. It disrupted his ability to carry out his function in the drug delivery chain. It was empathy. One day, the mother of one of his crew approached them and asked to buy crack. Chino recalls, seemed a look in my boy's face when his mom came to buy from us. It wasn't like a look of embarrassment. It was a look of hurt. Sometimes you can see the hurt on somebody. He said later, it's hard not to feel compassion for somebody. We are born with compassion. What breaks loose is my ability to feel not just what's happening to me, but what is happening to someone else. They sold her the crack. But it's hard to be Arnold Rothstein with a conscience. The more the pain of what he was doing intruded into his consciousness, the more he jabbed it away with violence or drugs. Chino wasn't a psychopath, but the prohibition system we have created required him to be one to play his role in it. So he drugged himself into psychosis. But prison had not been entirely a waste of time for Chino. A fellow prisoner taught him how to steal cars in Spofford. And when he was then caught for that, and sent back to prison, he learned how to be a blood, and ascend to a whole new level of gangsterism. At first, the other inmates assumed Chino was Hispanic. In some lights he looked black. In some, Native American. But the Latina gangs tried to recruit him because he looked most like them.
but he couldn't speak Spanish or relate to their world. That's when a girl called L.A. approached Chino and told him he could be blooded in, if he was prepared to work for it. Chino discovered the Bloods were a gang who originated on the West Coast out of the wreckage of the Black Panther Party and its revolutionary goals. The Bloods were the Bastards of the Party, a nickname so pervasive there's even a movie with that title. To become a Blood, he had to learn this history and all their ethical codes, which are written down like laws. You don't steal from your supplier. You don't drop a dime, that is, talk to the police, if you get caught. You don't do fucked up shit when you're flagging, that is, when you're wearing your official Blood colours. If you break these rules, there are very clear punishments, from lashes to death. Once he learned the codes, 9 Bloodettes crowded into a cell to watch Chino take the oath. It began with the words, Blood is 410% gangster. Now he was blooded. He had an extra layer of protection. From this day on, when he was locked up and severed from his crew, he had all the other crewless Bloods in the prison, watching his back. It was here, in these cells, that Chino first fell in love. When Chino saw a girl named Nicole, he felt a crazy lust, but could only express it with aggression and loathing. He had learned from his mother that that's what love is. He went to Nicole's cell and told her the head of her set was a faggot who was being raped in the ass, and that Chino was going to kill her. He made shooting noises. Then, one day, Chino got word that his girlfriend out on the streets, in the free world, had been raped. There was nothing that Chino could do from his cell to protect her, and he was distraught. Nicole came to see him and told him she was sorry to hear about what happened. Chino couldn't believe, after all he had done to her, that she was being so kind.
That literally changed me, Chino recalls. That one act of human compassion. I went into her cell and started talking to her, and all my shit stopped.
Nicole was released, and they lost touch, but something about the experience stays with Chino. But neither the Bloods nor the discovery of love could protect him from the people who seemed, from where he was standing, to be the toughest gang of all, the corrections officers. On the island, one officer, whenever he saw Chino, started taunting him.
You want to be a man, he said, but you'll never be a man. You're just a dyke.
Chino cursed back.
Why you so afraid of me, yo? Is it because you're not really a man?
The officer was especially incensed when Chino started going out with one of the most beautiful women on the island, a stripper named Demira. He had learned to love with Nicole, and now it seemed to be coming more easily to him. He could do this. He could care. It incensed the officer. So one day he grabbed Demira, pulled her into a facilities cupboard, and fucked her. There was nothing Chino or Demira could do. I was skeptical about this story when Chino first related it to me, but then I started doing some digging. A few years after the incident Chino was describing, it was revealed in court that abuse by prison guards is endemic in Rikers. New York State had to make huge payouts after it was proven, for example, that some guards encouraged the prisoners to smash in the heads of inmates they dislike. One day, Chino couldn't contain his anger anymore. He approached the rapist officer and told him he was a fucking coward who preyed on the weak. And if he'd had the nerve to try to drag him into the broom closet, he'd have been the one getting fucked. Later, in a revenge swipe, he had Chino locked in solitary confinement. There are many things you can do to a human. You can physically hurt them, you can spiritually pain them, but the most cruel and unusual way is to isolate them from all other human contact, he says. It's just too much, especially when you have so many demons. That lasted forever. He found himself slipping into a fantasy world, where he imagined he was rich and free. Dumped back outside onto the streets, Angrier than ever, Chino started leaning on crack more and more. His friend Jason said, when he was using it, Chino was just not there. Like, the lights are on, somebody put the radio on, but there's nobody at home. It wasn't like crazy, running around the street, stripping naked. He was subdued, maybe just a little off. It just seemed robotic, almost like the soul was turned off. The emotion wasn't within reach. What Chino got out of it, Jason says, was emotional numbness. A state where he did not seem to be able to access emotion. During that time, Chino was almost always in a lot of emotional pain. He was being kicked in and out of his house by his grandmother, dealing day to day and not being wanted by your family. The next few years passed in a crack blur. He knew there was more violence with his crew, more dealing, more prison, and a lot of watching TV. He started using heroin. It made things slow down when he needed them to. One of the few things that gave him hope was watching the Oliver Stone movie, Natural Born Killers. I feel like it's the first movie I've ever seen where the bad guys get away, he said. The bad guys always die at the end of the movie, unless you're a Freddy or Jason type. Whereas if you're just regular people-murdering motherfuckers, you always get yours in the end. But here, for once, the bad guys had some kids and did their happily ever after. One day, he woke up and realized he was so thin, I looked like a fucking Calvin Klein commercial. I couldn't take it anymore. He could feel Deborah's fate waiting for him. He began to see, it's like my mother was in a constant battle with her trauma, who she is, who she wants to be, all the time. Her demons were way deeper than drugs, way deeper than prison. I don't know what they were. They were her demons. I'm pretty sure I carry some of her, and now they're mine. He decided to quit all drugs except weed in one single swoop. He went to stay with a friend, who nursed him through the shakes, wiped up his vomit, and brought him glasses of water. Now, there was no more numbness to be had, he said. And so, flooded with feeling, violent torrents of feeling, he started to learn and read and think. He began to ask, had his life been shaped by a policy decision that didn't have to be made and didn't have to continue? Chino was standing on a New York street corner once again, pacing nervously and sweating a little. In front of him, there was a crowd of over 1,000 people, and standing next to him was a member of the House of Representatives. We were in Foley Square, in Lower Manhattan, on a spring day in 2012. Chino gave the word, and everybody, including me, marched behind him to One Police Plaza, the headquarters for the New York Police Department. He walked determinedly, alone, his eyes focused on the middle distance. When we arrived, words erupted from him, through a throat covered with a tattoo of the Egyptian wind sun god rising. "We're not demanding anything that's alien," he said. "We want justice, not just on the Upper West Side, but in Brownsville, Brooklyn, too. Not just in City Hall, but in Jamaica, Queens. Now, statistically, we know who smokes marijuana at higher rates. They don't look like me. They don't look like you. They look like Michael Bloomberg," then the mayor of New York. "But they don't face the collateral consequences of being deported, of having your housing taken, your financial aid stripped." The crowd started to chant with him. "No justice," said Chino. "No peace," they replied. And it echoed out across the police plaza, across to the Department of Justice. "No justice, no peace." He called this protest a tale of two cities. Everybody gathered here knew the raw fact that drug use is evenly distributed throughout New York City. In fact, the evidence suggests white people are slightly more likely to use and sell drugs. But in his neighborhood, there is crackdown, violence and warfare, while in the richer, paler neighborhoods, there is freedom and rehab for the few who fall through the cracks. Harry Anslinger's priorities and prejudices are still in place.
"Our communities are the ones that are targeted," he said to the crowd. "Our communities are the ones that are locked up and sent to booking so that they,"
he gestured toward Police HQ,
"can get overtime, because we know that it's about money. Because apparently, if it don't make dollars in New York City, it don't make sense."
The demonstration ended with the protesters, white, black, and brown in equal measure, sitting down and peacefully blockading the police building. Chino left to lead a class he took every week for young teenagers who were trying to stay out of gang life in the South Bronx. We jumped into a yellow cab and sped through Manhattan, pulling up outside a sign that said, "No exit." Behind it, in a library, there were teenagers waiting for him. They had been growing up on the same drug war battlefields as Chino.
"I don't like people," a 15-year-old girl said. "I barely leave my house. I just stick to myself."
She saw a boy get shot in the chin a few years back, she mentioned, almost casually. Her body language was turned inward, as if she were trying to shut herself down. Chino sat with her, listening intently. Next to her, a teenage boy reacted differently.
"I feel I could kill somebody if I had to," he said, with a smile full of swagger and sadness.
Until he was 21, Chino regarded the drug laws as a force of nature, as uncontrollable and irrevocable as the weather. But then gradually, in stages, over time, he uncovered something that was buried with Henry Smith Williams but keeps stubbornly rising in the minds of people. That, as he puts it,
"there's nothing natural about this."
The last time Chino got out of Rikers, he was surprised he had lived to be 21. He didn't expect it, nor did many of the people in his life. He was looking for a job that didn't involve breaking rocks or flipping burgers, when he heard about a summer internship at a local community group that was calling for an end to the seemingly inexorable building of prisons across New York State. He thought it was perfect for his girlfriend at the time, so he called up to get the details for her and started chatting to the staff on the phone. And they offered the internship to Chino on the spot. There, and in the years that followed, he began to read about the origins of the drug laws and punishments in America, and discovered something that surprised him. It began to occur to him over time that his story, Deborah's story, Victor's story, it didn't have to happen this way. It wasn't inevitable. What if it doesn't have to keep playing out, generation after generation? What if there is another way? On Chino's block, back in East Flatbush when he was a kid, there were no alcohol dealers selling Jack Daniels or Budweiser with a 9mm Smith & Wesson at their side. Yet this happened, this exact process, when alcohol was prohibited in the 1920s. The government fought a war on alcohol, and this led inexorably to gangs tooling up, creating a culture of terror, and slaughtering as they went. I spent weeks reading over the histories of alcohol prohibition, and there it was, this story repeating right through history. When the government war on alcohol stopped, the gangster war for alcohol stopped. All that violence, the violence produced by prohibition, ended. That's why today, it is impossible to imagine gun-toting kids selling Heineken shooting kids on the next block for selling Corona Extra. The head of Budweiser does not send hitmen to kill the head of Coors. Chino begins to conclude there wouldn't have been the same culture of violence, absolutely not, if other drugs were brought back into the legal economy. It wouldn't be such an extreme culture of violence, a continuous culture of violence. There will always be some people who are violent and disturbed and sadistic, but human beings respond to incentives. In Chino's neighborhood, the financial incentives for a kid like him were to step up to the violence and the sadism, because if he did, he would have a piece of one of the biggest and most profitable industries in America. And if he didn't, he would be shut out and left in poverty. He says, "A human is capable of anything if you're in fucked-up situations. You'd never drink your piss, but try not drinking anything for 20 days." As he explained this, I started to think of so much of the academic research I'd been poring through. Professor Jeffrey Miron of Harvard University has shown that the murder rate has dramatically increased twice in U.S. history, and both times were during periods when prohibition was dramatically stepped up. The first is from 1920 to 1933, when alcohol was criminalized. The second is from 1970 to 1990, when the prohibition of drugs was dramatically escalated. In both periods, people like Chino responded to the incentives to be terrifying and to kill in order to control an illegal trade. By the mid-1980s, the Nobel Prize-winning economist and right-wing icon Milton Friedman calculated that it caused an additional 10,000 murders a year in the United States. That's the equivalent of more than 3 9/11s every single year. Professor Myron argues this is an underestimate. Take the drug trade away from criminals, he calculates, and it would reduce the homicide rate in the United States by between 25% and 75%. Chino saw what the effects of taking drugs away from gangsters could be in his own life. In his early 20s, as he began to walk away from being a gangster, he decreed that his crew wasn't going to sell cocaine or crack or heroin anymore. That decision had a pretty rapid effect. "Our members dwindled because we didn't have resources," he explained. His crew couldn't buy fancy consumer goods or weapons anymore because they didn't have the cash. Several of them started to get legit jobs. "Take away the drugs, transfer them somewhere else, and the gang and the terror it perpetrates largely fizzle out." But the role of the drug war went deeper into Chino's story than that, to its very start. In the midst of all this violence, gang on gang, gang on police, police on gang, police on anyone in gang areas, the rape of an addict like Deborah became something that passed unpunished. It was not only normalized, Chino said, but accepted, and accepted in such an insidious way that it's almost overlooked. There's no level of humanity that it's acceptable for these people to be treated with. Instead, they are viewed in this very degrading, almost animalistic way. It's not just there's no sense of justice. There's no sense they need justice. They're so far down on the human level that justice doesn't even apply to them. That's one of the most tremendous impacts in the drug war. That is the question Chino found hardest as he rethought the drug war, the one that ate away at him. If a different drug policy had been in place, would his mother be alive today? "I firmly believe," Chino says, "that while I don't know intricate details of how it would be different, she would probably be alive. Maybe she would have dealt with her trauma as a patient, like she should have. Maybe I wouldn't have been a product of rape." This is one reason why he now believes we need to approach drug addiction not as a criminal justice situation, but more as a public health situation. Yet he found it hard to sit with this thought. I asked him in 2012, when Chino was about to turn the age Deborah was when she died, if he was angry with his mother. "I think so," he said, "even though I constantly try to make peace with it. I do. It's kind of hard to be angry with someone that's dead, right? But it's hard not to be when you only have about 10 memories and 5 of them are fucked up. You know what I'm saying? I don't have much goodness to reflect on. The only thing I can say is that she could have had an abortion. I was a rape baby. She chose to bring me into the world. That speaks to a lot. Everything else was demons and drugs and shit that got in the way. Chino chain-smoked as we talked about Deborah. I'm under no illusions that she would have been a great mom, even if she wasn't on drugs. I think she would have been a great dad, though, he said between puffs, laughing. Interestingly enough, I'm not mad that she busted my face open and stuff like that. I'm mad that she didn't stick around. I'm mad that I didn't get to watch her change or help her. At this stage in my life, if she was still alive and she was using drugs, we would find an answer to that problem, one way or another. And I know that's easier to say because that possibility's not here, but I hold on to it. I wrap myself in it like a blanket. Through his girlfriend, Chino recently met a woman called Miss Cynthia, who is in her late 50s, the age Deborah would be now if she had lived. She, too, has lost decades to heroin and crack, and to the scramble to get them from gangsters. She, too, is HIV positive. She has been clean now for 18 months. Chino went to her Narcotics Anonymous anniversary meeting with her recently, and he said to Miss Cynthia's children, I know you love the fact that your mother's clean, and I know you probably still have horrible memories of the things that she's done or didn't do when she was addicted. But you're fortunate, because you've gotten to see something I will never get to see, and that's your mother get clean. So hold dear to that. When I hear Chino talking on the phone to Miss Cynthia, I notice that he has started calling her Ma. Once his war was over, Chino had a name tattooed on his chest. Deborah, it says, in slanting letters. On the opposite side of his body, he had inked another name, one that surprises me. Victor. In many ways, he was a victim as well. He says carefully. It's rape. He had to be a victim at some level in his life to have the ability to commit such an atrocious act. Or the inability to see it's an atrocious act. I feel more sorry for him than angry. Do I think what he did was fucked up? Absolutely. But it's kind of hard to contextualize that because as much as it's fucked up, it produced me. Do I not want to be born? I want to be born, but not in such a horrible way. Armed with this new insight into the drug war, Chino became one of the leaders of the No More Youth Jails Coalition. When he started to talk about this to me, his voice changed, and suddenly he sounded like he had skipped from a Spike Lee movie to a policy wonkathon scripted by Aaron Sorkin. New York City, he explained, had committed to shut down Spofford, where he was imprisoned as a 13-year-old, and build two new state-of-the-art facilities. Instead, they built the new facilities and reopened Spofford, and announced plans for even more youth jails. Even though they were operating between 79% and 81% under capacity, and at a cost of $64.6 million that was in the capital budget, and that didn't entail what it would cost to operate. It was just the extra 100 jail cells. Despite all that money, the recidivism rate was over 80%, as opposed to an alternative to incarceration program. The chances are they might not come back, and it's cheaper. For 2.5 years, he organized marches and lobbying and ceaseless public pressure. He built a coalition of all the groups working in this field, using the management skills he had learned out on the street. He stood up and told legislators and journalists what it is really like in there, to be 13 and caged. And at the end of it, there was an announcement. The expansion of youth jails was halted in New York State. Spofford, Chino explains, is closed. It feels good. It feels really good, he said. But now, he shook his head. It still feels good to have a successful campaign, but it makes me realize how much more work there is to be done. For every little win that we get on the social justice side, it's a drop in the fucking ocean. So while it feels good, it's also daunting. He looked at me, and then looked away. Now Chino loves to go camping, way out in the middle of nowhere. He has a recurring daydream about being dropped in the wilderness, alone, and finding out if he could survive.
"You've got to understand, this happens all the time," says Kyungji Kate, Ree, who has worked with Chino for 10 years, and with kids in this area for even longer. "I honestly don't think it's that exceptional," she says about Chino's experiences. "I'm not mitigating the pain that she went through. It's just that this is happening on a scope and scale that the general public has no idea about. The disconnect is immense. We are just 10 minutes away from Brooklyn Heights," she says.
And shakes her head. "It's a different world." As I traveled from country to country, I started to realize that this story of a street dealer is only the story of the first layer of violence and criminality caused by transferring the drug trade into the illegal economy. Beyond Chino Hardin, there is another layer of gangsters controlling the neighborhood. Beyond them is a network of smugglers who transported the drugs from the U.S. border to New York. Beyond them is a mule who carried them across the border. Beyond them is a gang controlling the transit through Mexico or Thailand or Equatorial Guinea. Beyond them is a gang controlling the production in Colombia or Afghanistan. Beyond them is a farmer growing the opium or coca. At every level, there is a war on drugs, a war for drugs, and a culture of terror, all created by prohibition. I started to think of Chino, and all he has been through, as only one exploded and discarded shell left behind on a global battlefield. Chapter 6 Hard to be Harry. Two groups fight this war out with sweat and guns every night. One is Chino's side, the other is the police. As I spent time with Chino, I found myself wondering, how does all this look to the other army in this war? To find out, I interviewed 16 current or former law enforcement officers, from the Swiss mountains to the U.S.-Mexico border. But there was one I kept coming back to, again and again, over 3 years, because I could never quite understand her. I first met Lee Maddox around the same time I met Chino, in a restaurant in Manhattan, not far from where Occupy Wall Street had just erupted. Our meeting was arranged by an organization called Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, or LEAP. As she came into the restaurant, I saw she was a slender woman in her 50s, with brown hair, but she walked with the confidence of a person who is used to flashing a badge and making arrests. No matter how well I got to know her later, Lee always made me picture the Heather Locklear character in the 1980s TV series, T.J. Hooker. I always half expected her to suddenly tell me to duck so she could take a shot at some villain she'd spotted at the other end of the room. She ordered a glass of wine and started to tell me her memories of life on the front line of the drug war. At the very beginning of the 21st century, Lee Maddox was standing on the I-95, the long stretch of highway that leads into Baltimore. She was a police captain, with long hair and a short temper. Her men were waging the war on drugs by pulling over cars and hunting through them for contraband. Lee had been busting people for drug possession like this for years. Her cops had clear orders. Go for numbers. Get the maximum possible arrests. Don't worry about how severe the offense is. If a person is found with any drugs at all, even the tiniest roach, bust them. She was Anslinger's dream girl made flesh. Her officers all knew they could seize the property of anyone they arrested for drug offenses to be auctioned off, with much of the proceeds, usually 80%, going straight back into the local police budget. So if you stop a car and search it and find, say, $4 million in cash, not unusual. Shit, that's good, Lee said. Drugs were flowing so fast into Baltimore that hauling out users was like throwing your rod into a crammed commercial fishery. Her police force had taken all the measures Anslinger could never push through in his lifetime and put them into practice. Every night, army-style SWAT teams, using the latest military equipment, were smashing their way across the state. The prisons were crammed with people serving the harshest possible sentences. The streets were militarized. Harry's old instruction, "Shoot first," was believed to be the unofficial motto of the state's cops by many of the people who lived here. But for Lee, the fight was, by this point, about much more than that. She ended up here for a very personal reason. Lee first met Lisa Renee Taylor in gym class when they were 13 years old, and they almost immediately became friends. They looked so alike, both brunettes and slim, that a few years later they were able to share a fake ID to buy booze because nobody could tell them apart. They smoked weed and partied together and shared everything. Even their names sounded similar. Lee comes from a strict military family. Her dad was a lieutenant colonel in the U.S. Army. She left home when she was 18 to marry a jerk, mainly to anger her parents, but when she did it, Lisa was there as her maid of honor, just as she was always there for her. While Lisa studied chemistry at Salisbury State University, Lee was working as a cocktail waitress and a pizza delivery girl, but they stayed in constant contact. In June, during Lisa's first year at college, the girls met up in Ocean City, and they spent the day on the beach, talking and tanning. Lisa wore a white one-piece swimsuit with the stomach cut out. Lee wore a similar black and gold number. A couple of photographers came up to them on the sand and told them they could be models. A cheesy pickup line, but one that made them laugh. But Lisa, lovesick for her new boyfriend, John, decided she just had to see him and couldn't wait. She didn't have a car, and she didn't have the money for a bus, so she decided to hitchhike to his place in New Jersey. Late the next day, Lee got a call from Lisa's sister. She hadn't heard from her. "Oh, there's nothing to worry about," Lee said. "She's only gone to see John." The next day, Lee received a knock at her back door. It was hot, and she had no air conditioning. Through the door, she could see the silhouette of John standing there. "Lee, she never made it to New Jersey," he said. The police came and asked some questions and concluded that Lisa had run away. Lee told them it was impossible. She had left her makeup bag behind, and "Girls don't run away without their makeup bag." But they refused to investigate. The murder investigator assured Lee, "She'll pop up sooner or later." She didn't. The summer passed, and nobody heard from Lisa. Lee prayed a lot and told God if he got Lisa out of this, she would dedicate her life to doing good. She marched up the steps of the state police barracks and demanded an application to join. One evening, she was working as a cocktail waitress at the Sheraton Hotel in Bloomsbury, while her application was being processed, when she saw a headline on the TV news. "Body of missing woman found," it said. "My whole life stopped," Lee would say years later, "and all these people were still partying and having a good old time. And I was just standing there." Once she graduated from the police academy, she climbed to the third floor of the Salisbury State Police Barracks, where the files were kept, and forced herself to read every document on Lisa and look at every photograph of her to try to find out what really happened. Lisa had stopped by her mom's house and asked for some money, and they'd had some kind of argument, so she started to walk back to her dorm room, a mile away. She never made it. She ran into a drug gang, a group of at least 10 young men. Lisa was sexually assaulted by all of them, and at the end of it, she was stabbed 13 times and left for dead in a wooded area directly across the street from the university. Years later, after Lee had worked in policing for a long time, She would come to believe this gang was bonding itself together, establishing its reputation for terror, with a gang rape as part of its initiation.